Welcome to the Digital Forester Podcast, where we talk to foresters about how they are using digital technologies in their day-to-day forestry work. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Digital Forester Podcast. Today, I am joined by Kevin Shorthouse. He's the director and owner of Northwest Solutions. Kevin, how you doing?
I'm doing well, Kevin. And yourself?
Good, good. This is probably going to be like the all-time best pod because there's two Kevins on the podcast. So by default, it's got to rank the highest, most impressions and everything, right?
I think that's a fair assessment.
Yeah. Now your parents might have loved you and named you fondly as Kevin. Mine named me Kevin, I think, because my mother was watching Young and the Restless, and there's like a Kevin Newman soap opera character. And yeah, that's the untold story of how this guy got the namesake Kevin, but maybe you've got a cooler one. But hey, it's like we haven't chatted, seen each other in quite a long time. Whereabouts are you nowadays?
Yeah, so we're based out of Thunder Bay, Ontario, Canada. I run Northwest Solutions with my wife, Brandy, co-owner. She handles a lot of the business admin and payroll. So really, I feel like I work for her. That's where we are.
Too true. So you stayed up in the T-Bay, the Thunder Bay area, going, no changes there. Yeah, just love that neck of the woods.
Yeah. I've worked across Canada, BC, some in Alberta, but primarily we've really put our roots down here in Thunder Bay and travel across the Northwest region primarily. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing because you often hear about, you know, Vancouver, West Coast, Vancouver Island, all the water. But then you look at like a Thunder Bay or, you know, out east Halifax or other eastern places. But at least for me, when I go to Thunder Bay, I'm always amazed. Like this place hasn't blown up. You got the lake right there. You've got so many amenities. You got like outdoor stuff. Like you kind of got everything. But yet, I don't know, maybe time will tell, I suppose, as we go forward. But maybe start us off by sharing with us your journey. I know you are a trained forester. You've been at this for quite a while. As you said, you've worked across Canada, but maybe start us off with how you got into forestry in the first place.
Sure. Yeah. Like many people on the podcast, I've listened to a lot of episodes, big fan of the podcast. So familiar story here, you know, grew up really enjoying the outdoors, camping, climbing, hiking, fishing. The works around the Lake Simcoe area in southern Ontario, and didn't really know a career in forestry was a thing. I was more in the oriented to the STEM fields, I guess, you know, science, technology, engineering. But I also developed a pretty strong connection with the land growing up, working for farmers and one arborist in particular, and really enjoyed that sort of work. Farmers and a lot of our rural professionals are some of our, I think, unsung heroes, real problem solvers. You have to be innovative on the ground. A lot of technologies involved in farming and a lot of these more traditional industries now more than ever. Developed a strong correlation there with connection to the land and land management, and was really orienting myself to do arborist school out of high school, but my parents had other plans. My marks were apparently too good to quote unquote waste going to the tech diploma sector, which I think is a huge oversight in our society as a whole, as we're seeing now, huge mass shortage in tradespeople. But I think that's slowly starting to come around, hopefully, or at least the paradigm is coming around. I was sort of a toss up between engineering. I did a lot of sports, so I was also looking at kin, and stumbled into some forestry professors at a university fair and just started chatting and was really interested in the soils and the technology, this unique blend of a lot of different fields sort of converging into land management. And so then it finally was on my radar, came up to Thunder Bay. It was the closest forestry school for For those of us looking at an undergrad school in Southern Ontario, and really fell in love with the Thunder Bay area and just the vast wilderness that's up here.
Yeah, absolutely. And so for those listeners who may not know, I'm in Ottawa. I could drive 24 hours and I would get to Thunder Bay type of scenario. Like it's a vast stretch, but gorgeous, gorgeous territory there. And so just out of curiosity, like you mentioned Lakehead University being in Thunder Bay for school. Back then when you were making the decisions, was there like a, you know, a University of New Brunswick versus Lakehead U versus a University of British Columbia? Was there some element there of, I don't know if pedigree is the right word, but maybe just stock or bragging rights on these different forestry schools?
I suppose I'm more aware of it during my undergrad, taking it and then doing graduate studies and then also working at the university for a time. But when I was just in coming out of high school, wet behind the ears, I didn't really know. I knew Thunder Bay was already going to be a big stretch for my family, letting me go that far. So I kind of had a feeling that Western or Eastern Canada was kind of out of the picture at that time.
Yeah. So fascinating. So agriculture, and a bit of kinesiology, maybe interest there, and then you had forestry at Lakehead University, and so you did your studies there, obviously, and then catch us up to speed in terms of that career before you got to Northwest Solutions, because I believe it's quite broad and varied and lots of different touches there. But maybe give us the short summary of the forestry creds, street creds, or tree creds, I guess.
Yeah. Well, that's the neat thing with a lot of these professions. Forestry is not unique in this, I suppose, but I really took the opportunity in undergrad to travel primarily out west. There weren't a ton of jobs in Ontario at the time. You know, my class graduated in 2008, right during or slightly before, depending when you hit the timer of the crash, the housing crash, the US housing crash, which had a huge impact on the forest industry in Canada. The West Coast there's like a delayed buffer, if you will. And so I worked on the coast, the interior, northern BC, some in northwestern Alberta. And really, that's where I really cut my teeth in the operational side of forestry. And then the forest industry took a huge hit. It was sort of a toss up between changing careers, like a number of my classmates did, or allied careers, I should say. I would say over half my class is no longer like in classic forestry type jobs, but doing very well in various sectors, oil and gas, mining, heavy emphasis on environmental type related fields, because we do get that broad background in a traditional forestry education. Then ended up circling back to LU, Thunder Bay, as a way of pulling you back, and got a master's again in forestry science, but really focusing on supply chain optimization, being able to work for a little while in the field with boots on the ground, with logging companies, with the forest engineers, seeing, similar to the work that you're heavily involved in too, Kevin, this gap between the forest inventory and our manufacturing sectors, or at least primary manufacturing sectors, being the sawmills, pulp mills, veneer mills, and how can we link that up, get that a little bit tighter, instead of just thinking about volume by species? How can we start thinking about the best fit in terms of piece size, value recovery, product connections throughout that whole supply chain? I get really geeked out by that stuff, so I won't go down that rabbit hole too far. But yeah, that's what I really focused on in my master's, and then I bounced around a bit with a few different consulting companies, started teaching part time at the university, and then started doing some consulting as well, and then the past 4 years, I suppose, we've been doing the Northwest Solutions thing full time.
Wow. And how is that been going, being branching out, you know, running the your own shop, you know, having a partner, being your spouse, having employees have feelings apparently that you need to to
Yes.
nurture and cater to and dot dot dot. I'm sure many people are laughing listening to that, knowing what we mean, but they're instrumental in overall success. But how are things going? I guess thinking of that, 4 years in, what are you seeing in terms of services? Like, is it mostly services based, or is there visions of a product or something, given your background and experiences? But maybe introduce us or the audience to Northwest Solutions and some of the things that you guys do for people.
Sure. No, I appreciate that and the opportunity. We're primarily a service-based company. We do a lot of different things. Probably tied to my variety of background and experience. I see opportunities everywhere. We've had many chats in the past at various conferences, and right when at least to my mind. That's when AFRIDS and a lot of this tech that you were developing was really coming out and being a pioneer in the LiDAR space alongside guys like Murray Woods and Doug Pitt. Really, look up to that work, and it was really pioneering for the time. And at the same time, these paths sort of interweave, right? So we really try to work with our clients, both in forestry, some mining clients. That's a growth area for sure. And then, of course, working with our indigenous communities on land-based management and community-led plans. So there's a huge people aspect to everything we do, and then drilling into what their needs are, and then try to reverse engineer solutions to that end. So that was a long-winded way of saying that I wouldn't say that we like develop a specific technology, but we're adapters and innovators using a variety of technological tools to create those sort of customized solutions instead of just pushing necessarily one technology trying to solve all problems with one thing. So we'll whether that's using a combination of base data to answer land-based questions, whether it's a combination of satellite imagery, some drone imagery where we need that higher resolution or that rapid return interval, LiDAR when we have it, or if we need it, we can figure out ways to get it or scan it. And then developing those solutions for the clients.
Yeah, very interesting. Very interesting. So sounds like quite a bit of full service, like lots of different things that other digital foresters, it sounds easy, and yet we both know there's a secret sauce to delivering these services that actually achieve meaningful outputs. Now, you mentioned, out of curiosity, you mentioned mining. So obviously there's some growth up there. Are you sensing that that's, from the business point of view, kind of pulling you in different ways? And I don't ask that question in a negative context, as opposed to it's a resources market. There's cycles and stuff, and sometimes, well, all things, what is it, the tide rises all. Sometimes everything's going perfectly well, sometimes there's ebb and flow in others. But what are you seeing in your neck of the woods up there in Thunder Bay in terms of mining and forestry? Are they really firing in all cylinders, or is, as we're often hearing, forestry's tough spot right now, and is mining in that same space?
It's funny when you take the undergrad classes and you talk and you think about the cycles in industry. It seems so cut and dry and clear, and it's either in an up cycle or a down cycle. And I guess the cool thing about being in the innovation space or innovative services is there's opportunities in all these fields. There's growth areas in all these fields. Yes, forestry is in a downward market cycle in the commodities, but there's a lot of still yet a lot of that drives innovation. My colleague, you've had him on be here before, Alex Billick. Many chats, and we sort of did our undergrad and master's together, or very allied in time and sort of what we were interested in. And there's these market cycles, but it's a driver of innovation. It really is. For those that want to see the opportunities and find efficiencies, it's like a catalyst. Although there's some pain along the way, it tends to be a catalyst for those that are looking for innovation. Yes, unfortunately, some people have to close up shop, just can't make it work. But the groups that I've thankfully been able to work with, I've sort of refined our list of clients to a smaller group of like-minded people that embrace technology, that don't just think about the cost element, although that's important. They also think about like the return on investment side. And so things may cost a little bit more upfront, but if implemented properly, it can lead to a lot of cost savings or a higher return on investment downstream.
Yeah, for sure.
And then circling back to your mining question. Yeah, so mining exploration, where we're in another growth phase there. This year, the capital markets for a lot of exploration is a little bit down this season, but overall, I think the potential for growth in the mining sector, especially around critical minerals, is going to be it's going to be a medium to long-term growth trend for sure.
Yeah, very cool, very cool. Yeah, and being up in Thunder Bay there, I think you're well placed to capitalize, take advantage of a lot of those opportunities. And absolutely, like, it's one of those things I think I've seen time and time again when there's a downturn. The ones that generally, those that are maybe playing the longer game, like, this is the time where they're actually investing in the downturn versus waiting for things to turn around. Time will tell, I guess. So very cool. So I'll make sure to get you to lean this way, because earlier when you were there was a bit of interference, static there, but it's okay. We'll correct for that. He's an Android user listener, so that's probably the problem, right? I'm on a Mac, so everything's working flawlessly well. But no, it's just a bit of static there. I'm just taking a jab at Kevin there. So cool. So let's get into a bit of technology, because again, you fit, like many other folks, the perfect digital forester in terms of your education, your training. You got boots on the ground, you've seen it, you lived it. You're seeking to do things better. You've got the quiver with a bunch of arrows and adding more arrows to figure out how to solve these problems. But from your seat, what are you seeing as a professional services, a consulting services? What are you seeing trend based in terms of technology? Is there a common, maybe I'll ask it this way, what's today the common toolkit that you would say every digital forester must have?
Okay, a common toolkit. Well, yeah, as we often say with some of my colleagues, ArcGIS, or at least GIS, doesn't have to be ArcGIS. I'm not sponsored by ArcGIS. In fact, we pay them lots of money every year
Yeah,
for our
you won't see a
licensing.
link pop up here, folks, to click on the Esri link, by the way. So no sponsorship whatsoever.
No, but various GIS platforms is sort of GIS is like sort of Microsoft Office for foresters. That's sort of a common term we like to throw around. There, it's rarely that an office day goes by that ArcGIS isn't used in some form, or QGIS, or some combination thereof. So that's a huge part of it. Having all the database knowledge, learning a little bit of coding, a little bit of scripting, can certainly make you a little bit more dangerous in the workspace for sure. Some automation, the AI element. I consider myself not an advanced user of AI, but we certainly do use it and integrate it into our workflows in a variety of forms. Yeah, it's an exciting space there for sure. LiDAR is, a big thing, especially in Ontario, where Ontario is a little bit behind the eight ball in Canada, but we're catching back up quickly. It's a huge land base to have to scan and to work with, huge data sets. So getting more and more familiar with those data sets and how to use them efficiently and get them into the hands of our operators, in the hands of the end users, so to speak. Not just on a forester's MacBook or PC, and having that knowledge and some data. We talked about database knowledge. Drones is a big theme, right? Having at least a basic one in the back of the truck for augmenting the field work. It doesn't. And all this technology, I hear it a lot. Like when they see the maps and the high resolution data products that we can produce, like, oh, Kev, like this is going to replace boots on the ground. I'm like, no, it's not. Absolutely not. There's no way. There's just too much environmental responsibility and regulation that we need to manage to a high level of detail to keep our social license to operate on the land and to meet those critical thresholds. But I'll tell you what, it sure makes those boots on the ground more efficient, having this technology.
Yeah, for sure. 100%. And were those foresters that were making that comment, or was it like people on the periphery watching what you're doing?
A combination.
Okay.
Combination of both. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. A combination of both for sure.
So it still hasn't gone away. There's still that perception of, these magical things are going to make me redundant. And you and I both know it's far from the truth. We might just be repurposing your boots in a better way. But definitely anyone who says no boots on the ground, we know to cast those heretics to the side there. So I'm curious, can you maybe describe for us, our listeners, just to get a flavor of, what Northwest Solutions can do for you, not just, Canadian companies, North American companies, even abroad, but can you maybe give us a summary of, I'll say two projects, the coolest project Northwest Solutions has worked on, and then the most painstaking, painful, frustrating, but learn lots from project, because we all have one of those. And despite the heads down, we do come out with lots of learnings and new things. But maybe can you give us a sense of the two examples of those types of projects?
Sure. So I'll take one from like one of the earlier days. It wasn't, there were some painful moments, but we sure, like you said, we sure learned a lot. I actually worked with Alex Billick on this one. We called it the Precision Forestry Project, sponsored through Cribe and Resolute Forest Products, was a huge partner in this. And that's earlier on when drones, at least consumer and sort of smaller business level users for drones and drone technology was becoming a thing. We were testing a lot of this technology to its limits. This is well before NAV Canada or Transport Canada had the restrictions they do now, or requiring your basic or your advanced pilot's license or special flight authorizations for beyond line of sight. So we were kind of creating a playbook as we went, and testing technology to its limits. And to the point where we had to survey this large area, and the drones did not have the range that they do now. So we had to get in via boat, canoe, and we were packing all this high tech gear with us across portage and into lakes and all sorts of weather, trying to keep these things dry. They don't like water, most of them anyways, and launching these drones and amazingly, truly amazingly, we did not lose one drone, but there's a couple times where we came very, very close where we were practicing, because in the boat, there were small boats, so you couldn't like land it on any sort of platform. It was too small of a space. The drones didn't have the automation or the stabilization they do now, where they can land almost exactly where they took off from on their own with multiple range sensors. So we practiced launching and catching these drones by hand from first on land, and then that's how we were deploying these things in the boat. And as you can imagine, when you combine some wind and currents and all the rest of it, the logistics of weather, there's some pretty close calls. Nobody lost any fingertips, so that was good. But one thing with the drone technology, they fixed this now, but the onboard compass to tell which direction it was flying its automated mission in. Well, I don't know if you've ever been in the field, Kevin, when you're near any sort of magnet rock or ferrous rock and the needle on your compass starts going wonky. Well, the needle in the drones also started going wonky too. And we were telling it to fly this mission, and it got on a weird path and it just was gone. Like it was not coming back. And it, now they have that the built-in software and tools, I guess, where it can tell that there's something weird going on, and it'll just fly strictly by GPS or ignore that sensor. But they didn't have that then, so you'd be fighting this drone to bring it back. And when it wanted to go home, and it thought home was way over there, across the lake or in the lake, and we're having to land these things and catch them. So, a bit of blood pressure spike,
No
but
kidding,
we've
man.
certainly learned a lot through that whole process for sure, using the drone
Wow.
technology.
Wow. So I should almost give you a call you like drone catcher or something, like some relic like nickname or something. But yeah, I can picture you guys doing this, right? And everything. Like it's supposed to work perfectly well. And I'm sure there are some the other funny stories that come along. Yeah, that's very cool. So is that this cool one or is that the frustrating one?
Well, I guess it was innovative, but there were some frustrating moments for sure, trying to see what this technology could do, and breakdowns in a remote setting, and trying to fix different sensors in the field with limited access to power. We were soldering together different sensors to fly on the same drone, like a thermal camera and
Wow.
our RGB cameras, to try to link them together. Before you had manufacturers coming up with this stuff, sort of out of the box. It's just plug and play, and then we'd have to try to sync this stuff later. It was definitely an interesting time to be experimenting with the drones. And then more, I guess more recently, one of the neat things we're able to do with different resource sectors, both utilities and the mining sector, is leveraging the knowledge we have with access roads, and leveraging the LIDAR for planning resource access, and some software, leading software developers like RoadEng that have they've been integrating in some of their newer platforms. We've been a beta tester for RoadEng for a long time. I taught various labs at the university with RoadEng, and actually used it way at the beginning of my career out west, when you have your traverse. I don't know if you know what a manual traverse is, but you're tight chaining between stations, when GPS was just not even close to being good enough. It's pushing like 20 years, 15 to 20 years ago. Trying to survey by GPS was just starting to catch on out there, and so we'd have to manually enter these traverse and terrain data into RoadEng to build a very basic model of the block and where the roads are going to go, tying everything together. And now we can leverage LIDAR terrain models and soil data together to get our soil depths, and to really optimize our roads through very tough terrain. So that's probably one of the coolest projects we're able to work on, both for mining and forestry. A lot of synergies there in resource access roads. We're seeing a lot of potential in that area for optimization.
Very cool, very cool. And so for our audience who may not be familiar with RoadEng, can you maybe give a quick shout out synopsis on what RoadEng is and some of its main use cases? And maybe also, I know you mentioned CRIBE earlier, just to give CRIBE a shout out, maybe break down that acronym and what their mission is, just for our other listeners that may not be from Canada.
So CRIBE is a government agency that helps fund various R&D, very industry-oriented R&D projects across Ontario, really focused on the bioeconomy. So inventory and supply chain optimization was sort of our fit into that space, and that's basically what CRIBE is, and it's been a real driving force, if you will, a real accelerator for innovation in this space in Ontario. And then RoadEng, they've been around a long time, and have kept pace with the technology, leading the space in a lot of ways. So really, the name kind of says it all. They're really focused on roads, and in the engineering, bringing like real fundamental engineering knowledge and expertise to resource roads. They're used both in a civil, municipal context, but their roots, no pun intended, are in forestry, and they've also been branching out into the mining sector and wind farms and various resource roads. And they're really a three-dimensional design space. So it's different from, say, GIS and in the platforms that there's definitely overlap, like especially their terrain module has a lot of overlap with various GIS platforms, but they're unique spaces, optimizing cut and fills, optimizing alignments, so your vertical and horizontal alignments on roads, whether you're trying to build a road to a 40 kilometer hour speed limit or an 80 kilometer hour speed limit. So bringing a lot of that fundamental engineering into the land management space.
Yeah, very cool, very cool. And so thinking, you mentioned you talked about drones, and again, no, like Kevin times two here. We're not sponsored by anyone, but when we talk about drones, like, is there nowadays a de facto, I don't want to say industry drone leader, but maybe the go-to drone for foresters, or is it still a mix depending on use cases? Is there one that, like, I'm assuming for some stuff, it's still maybe if you're just having fun doing some recon, it's going to Best Buy, the local shop, and getting something. But I also know some folks are flying some pretty more sophisticated ones. But what are you seeing on the ground? Are you seeing like kind of players or customers converging on a certain type, or I won't say brand, but type, and that comes with certain capabilities?
Yeah, like I'll try to steer clear from brand naming, I think, a little bit here. But it really depends on the use case. Like you said, there's the Best Buy sort of consumer grade drones that are not so bad for just quick recon if you want a
DJI,
nice
yeah.
video. Kevin's
Yeah,
not scared. It's your podcast. We can talk
exactly.
wherever we
DJI,
want.
Best Buy DJI. Everyone knows that, yeah.
Another one that's certainly worth looking at is Autel, for your more basic recon. So they have some heavier drones that make some really nice imagery products. There's a lot of movement right now in the seating space where our company isn't involved in that. On the sales side, we're very much focused on the operations and planning side of things. So there is it's a huge growth area, as you know, and I'm looking forward to seeing the sensory, the 360 sort of spherical sensory of the drones to be able to there's been some experimentation. I haven't seen any home runs yet, but to be able to fly mid canopy in our scuzzy mixed woods in northern Ontario, our very brushy mixed woods, not like the nice manicured Scandinavian forests of and various ones across Europe. But yeah, I'm excited to see that space continue to develop.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I think Iridium, one of the satellite constellation players, they recently had some press around some things they're doing with beyond visual line of sight flights. What are you seeing up with your customers? Like, is that something you had the flying beyond visual line of sight, you had the whole, I won't say buzzword, but the swarm drones that could work together and coordinate. What are you seeing with the customers? Is that something they talk about still, or is it really just back to basics of it's a mapping instrument that, depending what we're trying to do, we'll just pick the right one for the purpose? What are you seeing more on the advanced topics of maybe drones and UAV, UAS?
Yeah, okay. So on the swarm side of things, it's an interesting idea. I know there's been some proof of concepts or some tests. The regulation around them is still somewhat prohibitive, because there's, to my knowledge, and again, I'm not an expert in the swarm space at all, but you still need one pilot per drone to be monitoring each one, because in theory they could, it's always worst case scenario, they can break out of whatever formation or automated flight plan that they're in, and you need to be able to maintain control over each drone independently. So that becomes, although the opportunity to cover a large swaths of area in a short amount of time is good, personnel time is expensive, and so the cost benefit, I think, is yet to be seen. Perhaps once it gets to the point where it's regulated that you can do that en masse with one or two people, then perhaps you'd have that efficiency, but your biggest cost oftentimes is just getting out there. Your travel time, the truck, whatever equipment, and your personnel time. So yeah, we're seeing more foresters having drones in their kit as just one of the tools in the toolkit for basic recon. It's definitely a very valuable tool for doing initial timber recon or checking up on operations, doing integrated into compliance monitoring. It's not a requirement, but it certainly is a helpful tool because, as we know, helicopter time is rather expensive. And so it certainly, when you're comparing it to boots on the ground, it can certainly help target that field work to try to optimize it.
Yeah, very, very interesting. Very interesting. And so when we think about drones, again, maybe if we, I'd be curious to pick your brain. When we think about, you mentioned drones that might be able to navigate under the canopy, humanoid drones, if we're going in that AI space, a lot of talk there, the Boston Dynamic dogs, all sorts of these things. What are your thoughts on that? Is that the future? Overkill, too much, or maybe what's the saying? A sledgehammer when you only need a hammer. What's Kevin Shorthouse's view on the future as it comes to maybe the non-human side of things? Is that something that you think we're going to see in the next decade or lifetime, or do you think it's more hype than what it actually has to offer?
Well, one of the other projects that we worked on is, and it ties back to my master's in this big innovation space we've seen with aerial lidar, and I'll come back to drones in a second because it's, again, I as I, it seems to be the theme with our business at least. Instead of just chasing down one technology and seeing how far we can push it, which is very important, I always come back to what's the goal. What does the client need, or what does the sector need? What are they asking for? And then reverse engineer the best solution we have available to that, or a potential future one. And one thing that's really exciting, we can certainly get those three-dimensional scans using terrestrial lidar, and getting that side profile is really exciting because then you can take those that three-dimensional scan of trees or logs. Even it doesn't even necessarily have to be three-dimensional. There's a lot of neat work being done by a variety of groups just using one scan from one side of the tree, but the whole point being from that oblique angle versus just top-down angle, and then how do we marry the two? There's a lot of research being done in that space. My company isn't directly involved in it, but I see it as a huge area for potential. And then but collecting that terrestrial, we were involved in a couple of projects years ago, and we were packing around that FARO unit, which was for its time, fairly portable. But when you're thinking about crashing through the bush on a grid and trying to deploy this, it's pretty expensive data. Very useful data, but pretty expensive data to go collect. I think it would be very exciting to see. And I don't think we're that far away, certainly within the next 5 to 10 years. It's been successful in much cleaner forests, if you can say that, that have less stuff in the way. But to be able to fly, because that's the other challenge too, when you set up that ground station LiDAR that we found, we had to clean out a lot of the understory to actually get a clearer picture of the trees because of the amount of shadow, or you'd have to do like six or seven different scan locations for one plot, and each scan was at that time. I'm sure it's much faster now, but that scan would take like 20 minutes each. So pretty expensive data at the end of the day. But if we were able to fly mid canopy, you're above a lot of that understory vegetation, fly mid canopy and side scan with LiDAR a lot of the trees or merchantable timber. And be able to reverse engineer that. That'd be a neat product in and of itself, but then to be able to reverse engineer that and tie it to aerial LiDAR, it'd be some pretty powerful calibration data. It's not dissimilar to a lot of the work being done in Scandinavia. JD Irving's had a couple pilot projects in this too, I believe, using harvester head data and its GPS location, and then reverse engineering that to LiDAR that was flowing prior to being harvested, and using that as your training data. And then be able to then forecast with a little bit more accuracy for product yields, at least, to unharvested areas. So yeah, I see a lot of movement happening in the next 5 to 10 years in that space.
Yeah,
Yeah.
very cool. Very cool. And so thinking as you're looking at your work and building up your business, are there certain themes for Northwest Solutions that you and Brandy are kind of saying, we're going to invest in these? And if so, what can you share on that front based on where you're seeing technology, people, companies, the industry in general going?
We see opportunities in a lot of different subsectors of several resource industries, forestry and mining being probably the top two. But the top themes I think would be roads, resource roads. I know that sounds for a lot of really techie people may sound they may take it for granted perhaps or just think boring, it's just a road. From the resource sector side, both mining and forestry and other resources as well, you really make or break the operation economically with your roads, like where you put them, how efficiently they're built, what standard they're built to. So I see a lot of growth area there for a variety of groups, really leveraging the LIDAR along with soil data, because LIDAR is really good at the surface, but subterranean information, especially when you're on the Canadian Shield and you're dealing with shallow to very shallow soils, some of the areas that we're being pushed into operationally, to put it in perspective, my entire time in Ontario until this last road project, I'd never seen blasting used. When I worked on the West Coast, it was used on almost every kilometer of road. Their average road cost on the coast was probably on average close to an order of magnitude higher per meter or per kilometer than it is in Ontario, but we're starting to see the use of the requirement to use blasting more and more. And traditionally, it would be like, no, we're just going to bring in a ton of fill and either get over this hill or build around it. But using tools, shout out Road Eng again, using tools like Road Eng, we were actually able to look and optimize and show that no, it's actually, even though it's very expensive to blast, it's actually more cost effective overall with a much better, straighter road to blast strategically in various locations. It's so that's one big growth area. And then of course working with the communities in the north, trying to build up capacity, really emphasizing community-led projects, and we just come alongside as a resource, as a technical resource, or helping to push their ideas and their plans through the regulatory bodies and the bureaucracies that need to get approvals in place to make things happen, but really emphasizing that they're community-led.
Interesting, interesting. And I was kept waiting to see if I would hear that word carbon come in. Are you seeing that at all on your space? And it's not a leading question. I don't really I care, don't care. I have no position on carbon, but as a consulting firm or a professional services firm, is that something that's kind of bubbling up in your neck of the woods, or is it really other jurisdictions that are playing that
Oh,
carbon game?
it's certainly here. Yeah, we've I think intentionally it's a pretty saturated space. I think there's obviously opportunity for growth, but there's a tremendous amount of uncertainty around it too, and how the modeling is done. You've had some experts on, Elias, that it's one of these carbon modeling experts, and he's really good at pointing out some of the, I guess, fatal flaws in a lot of the carbon evaluations. And so we've sort of intentionally not been playing in that space, but it's alive and kicking, and it's a big part of the planning for the future, especially around renewable energy, bioenergy, helping to subsidize essentially those types of initiatives using carbon credits. But again, those markets are a little, as probably even better than I do, are a little shadowy at times.
Yeah.
Exactly how those markets are going to develop and how we can integrate them into operational decisions.
Yeah, that's the funny thing is that when we think about carbon, right, it's like, a lot of people are like, oh, like that's such and such people should be experts. And aside from carbon and maybe, chemistry, it's like that's probably the limit, of being an expert in that space. But yeah, Dr. Elias Ari from Rhinoster, he's definitely being in the mix, maybe it would be the best way of summarizing some of his audits and assessments of things. So as we look at the future, to maybe take a couple minutes here to see what you're thinking. If I was to pull you out 10 years, what does the world look like in forestry? What does Northwest Solutions look like? What would you like to be as an entrepreneur leader? What would you like your community? Sounds like Thunder Bay's home. What would you want that to look like? But if I was to pull you out 10 years, how would you describe what 10 years looks like for you?
Yeah, okay. So that's a pretty multifaceted question. Certainly for the sector, forestry, even though we're branching a little bit into the mining sector and other resources, forestry's still home. It's gonna be a soft spot for sure. I think, and there's a lot of good people on the industry side pushing for this as well, but seeing more investment in product diversification. I know that's a big buzzword, but actually, continuing to move not away from commodity products is similar. I saw a really good talk in undergrad. This is going back quite a ways, but sort of showing the similarities between the petroleum sector and the forestry sector. In the sense that you have a huge amount of raw resource, but that can go into a variety of product streams. And there's certain commodity products that you need to get at those higher value specialty products. So you always need that base load of commodity products. But continuing to see innovation into those specialty products and advancement and investment in that, I think would do our sector and our communities that rely on the sector, a huge service to see further investment in diversification. Certainly for sure.
Yeah, definitely interesting. And so for those who are listening and maybe not watching the video side, the YouTube. So like Kevin's not an old dude. He's like a relatively young guy. So this is why I wanted to ask the question and I guess we're both not that old, not that young per se, but when we think about forestry, we keep hearing about the workforce and there being a shortage in workforce. Are you seeing that yourself? I suspect it's a loaded question, I guess. The answer is yes. But what are your thoughts on the gap, the shortage in the workforce? What would you suggest would be a way to fill that? Because you even mentioned some of your peers of your graduating class of your alma mater, right, having gone mining and like environmental and different things and didn't stay within the forestry space. What do you think the challenges have been, and what would be your suggestion to all the global digital foresters out there that are struggling with recruiting talent and because the AI side, the automation, it's not coming tomorrow. Like it's still going to be decades out there. But what do you think the challenge is, and what would be your solution, I guess, to pull in more of that talent or build that capacity and capability?
Yeah, no, it's a huge challenge, and not just across our sector, across many sectors in Canada. You used to hear about it in specialty jobs or fields. But now it seems every whether I'm at my doctor's office or at my mechanic shop, finding capable people and younger talent seems to be a resounding theme, and that's a function of population dynamics, right? We have an aging baby boomer bubble that's starting to age out of the workforce. And not as many young people coming in behind. So, we're heavily reliant on immigration in this country to keep things rolling, which I see as a very positive thing. Finding additional pathways to integrate those folks into in new people, new entrants into the workforce is certainly a challenge, and needs to be a continued area of growth for sure. starting younger, you know, like our most recent job ad, we didn't even put a diploma or a degree as a prerequisite for the first time. And there was actually a lot of applicants. My wife and I were actually in business partner, we were just discussing that earlier today, and going to be, you know, contacting certain individuals for some interviews coming up here. But not being afraid to go a little bit outside the norm and starting younger, or at least, and I think promotion too. Forestry and foresters, you know, and I'm just as guilty because I don't go to nearly as many conferences as perhaps I should. But we're not very good at self-promoting as a whole, as a sector. And we're really good at maybe peer-to-peer and our old classmates and a lot of these conferences where you see the, you know, very, very familiar faces, but that, you know, that's already you're preaching to the converted, so to speak. You know, I think we as a sector need to keep looking at different demographics, looking younger. You know, I think of, oh gosh, the names escape me right now, but Women in Wood, that initiative. SFI's got some great initiatives, Project Learning Tree, the mentorship program, and to trying to recruit and just getting people that maybe you're on the fringe or don't have much experience or don't know much about it, different options to come inside and create that mentorship environment. Because I've had some really good mentors in my life and my career. I feel really grateful for that. And I think we need to really cultivate that culture, almost bring it back. Coming out of the downturn, we lost a lot of good people of that crash of 08. A lot of innovative thinkers that didn't disappear. They just took their innovative, very bright minds over to other fields, right? I'm thinking of a lot of my classmates that have done that, and they're doing very well. But to sort of try, how can we cultivate that culture of mentorship and of openness to try to bring new people into the field?
Yeah, very cool, very cool. Yeah, there's times I wonder with some of the registered professional programs that foresters sign up. It's almost like, you know, add on a massive due to that, and then like everyone just pool those dues, you know, set aside for storytelling or something. Because I know I've gone to a lot of workshops, conferences where people will talk about, oh, as a forester, you have to do a better job telling your story. And I'm like, but these are guys and girls who just like to not talk and go out to the bush and do their thing. So, you know, is that really a possibility, I guess, for people to come out of their shell more than maybe what they're comfortable doing? Time will tell. So hey, as we look to wind down, I know we've kind of bounced around on all sorts of different topics. So then truthfully, I just enjoy catching up with you as well to see where you're going and some of your thought processes, since it's been a while since we've connected. And so thinking of the broader forestry domain, what's the far out question? If you were to be the CEO of, let's say, one of the big Northern Ontario companies, or any big forestry company for that matter, what would be the thing? What would be that initiative or key strategic project that you would put in place? What would it be? It could be technology, it could be people, it could be something else, but just based on your broad experiences as a change maker, where would you focus your priorities or efforts?
Okay. Well, when I think about some of the really memorable experiences in my career that sort of help, you know, those aha moments in someone's career, like, you know, where all of a
They're the
sudden you start
best.
connect, yeah, you start connecting those dots and starting to see the bigger picture as well as the more minutiae, individual components. Due to modernization and sort of the Ford manufacturing model, where someone, you know, has one job on that manufacturing line, and they do that very well and very efficiently. Where I think we've knocked that out of the park in North America and in Western society as a whole. Where I see a huge opportunity for growth, both to make it more attractive to new entrants, but also to help innovate people that are currently in the workforce. You know, there's most of the loggers I work with and harvesting contractors have never seen the inside of a sawmill, have never seen the inside or any of the manufacturing process, what makes their operation tick, and of a pulp mill or any of the higher value products. And to be able to get people, not necessarily cross-trained, but at least cross-exposed, if I can sort of make a hybrid term there. Because I remember when I worked for West Fraser, one of my summers at West, one of the first things they got us to do after doing all the indoctrination and safety briefings and SOPs, yeah, you know, the really fun stuff for the first week. One of the first things they had us do was, let's go through the sawmill. Let's go through some of our partnering mills. You know, this is why our quality specs in the field matter. And you need to communicate that and why it matters in the field. And when you're planning out blocks and trying to evaluate timber, this is what matters. You know, this whether it's a form or a quality thing or a rot, branch size, all these things that go into making a sawmill tick. And that's just one product manufacturer. That was really pivotal for me. And so being able to expose people to other parts of the supply chain so that they can help them see how what they do integrates to that larger picture, not just seeing it on a flow chart in a board meeting. That's great and all, but like, let's get people out in the field. Maybe some of these armchair foresters need to get their boots dirty once in a while too, and have a look at the forest that they're managing from their office. And I know they do. It's not a criticism. It's just life gets busy. Everyone has a lot of demands on their time. But yeah, that sort of cross exposure for various people along the supply chain to be able to see the other components, I think would really help with creating a little bit more synergy across the sector.
Yeah, that's amazing, amazing, amazing thoughts there, and I love it because I know when I chat with people, especially folks working in forestry, often some of the bright minds, like, they didn't come from traditional forestry programs, and the comment is, oh, had I only known back when I was doing this program, I would have done forestry for sure. I just didn't know, right? And that's where at times I wonder, you know, a lot of some of the more STEM oriented universities, right? They have the co-op programs and stuff. And that's where I've thought at times, like with some of these forestry companies, I'm like, just advertise these co-op programs, like that are not traditional forestry programs, and see who bites, or offer these internship programs, you know, paid ones where, you know, they can come work for a summer, people who are not classically trained as foresters. And maybe the needle starts shifting where people start transferring into forestry programs. I don't know. I find it a fascinating topic on the people side. So anyhow, mm-hmm. I know we're at time. I enjoyed chatting with you. I know folks who are listening probably have some questions or maybe interested in more of the things that you're able to do. So for those people who want to get a hold of you, Kevin, what's the best way for them to reach you? Is it social, website, email, phone? What's the number one way, easiest way to get a hold of you?
Yeah, all of the above. Yeah, we have a company page on LinkedIn. Email is great. I don't know if you want to fire some of those coordinates in the show notes. Yeah, any of those will work fine.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to do that. So if email's the easiest, what is it again, Kevin, at
northwestsolutions.ca.
There you go. I always get people, then they don't have to look it up. Kevin at northwestsolutions.ca if you want to speak with Kevin Shorthouse. So, hey, it was great chatting with you. I really appreciate you making the time to talk to this guy. It was good seeing you, and I'm looking forward to connecting with you off the digital screen at some point in the near future.
That'd be fantastic. Thanks a lot for having me on, Kevin. I really appreciate it.
Awesome. It was great talking with you. Bye for now.